to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time. Let's see what we can find. Oh, come on, walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. on a2zen.fm, and we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show page. We also have interviews that, though have been recorded, are available to listen to before they make it to the airwaves. You go to the interviews page. I've separated them in that fashion. The radio show page is just that. The programs that you heard right here on the radio program or a2zen.fm, the interviews page are those that are coming to your radio station or a radio station near you. So we certainly hope that you will check that out. And also check out our guest's website. We don't reinvent the wheel. We don't create a bunch of pages for the guest and all of the materials. They've done that for us. They've already invented the wheel. We just, we kind of hook onto the trailer hitch, so to speak. And we certainly hope that you will take advantage of that as well. We are excited about being here with you every week, and we hope that you are excited about hearing about these different guests and the work that they are doing. It's kind of the first question that I usually ask my guests when we're doing a get-to-know-you interview. This is before the broadcast, and that is usually, so tell me about the work that you do. Well, we're going to find out about the work that our guest Richard Moss is doing regarding the deep work for essential change. He is the maestro of deep work for essential change, and he has written a book called Inside Out Healing, Transforming Your Life Through the Power of Presence. Presence. Richard Moss, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Oh, thank you, Richard. So, if you just heard my cell phone go off, it's now closed. It can't go on. I apologize for that little dancing of noise there.
Well, fortunately for our listeners, they didn't hear that, but that's okay.
Oh, then I didn't have to confess.
No, but I thank you.
Oh, my God.
But confession, they say, is good for the soul, so there you go. Your soul is cleaner now. Be that as it may, thank you again for joining us. It's great to have you on the program, and I'm going to give you a quick analogy as we get started here, because what you are talking about, I think, is absolutely vital. As we are talking here today, and I'm watching my screen as the voice is being created visually on my screen, there's a little white line that stays to the right side of the view meter, if you will. And to the right of that is nothing. It's blackness. It's the great void. But to the right, there's all of the jiggly lines that make up my voice and your voice. But it's that white line. And I came to this realization about a year or so ago. I've been in this business for over 30 years, and I only came to this realization about a year ago. That white line represents the here and the now.
Mm-hmm.
This moment. And that the moment that I can see the creation of the wave of my words and your words, not in the moment anymore. And the void, where there is nothing, that's the past. There's nothing there. No, I take that back. That's the future. That's the future yet to be created. The past is what's been created here and is flowing past with the little jiggly lines. And really, if I'm understanding, that's really what you are, so to speak, pushing here and promoting is here, now, right this instant. No place else but here now is where we need to be living.
I think, I'm promoting that because it's the place where human beings access their own deepest intelligence. There really is a kind of limitless wisdom that we can access, But we don't access it through intellect or thinking or memorized information. Applied and memorized information has tremendous value. And as you may be aware, I was a physician. I was a practicing physician. We learn, we memorize a lot. But by learning to be very present, I know that's almost become hackneyed lately, but to learning how to be present means you actually start to process information much, much faster than other people. You can access or assess what's useful, what's not useful, when a person's really in integrity with what they're saying, or whether it's coming from a belief system in them and their bodies aren't part of it. And there's an enormous difference in the voice quality of a human being when they speak from belief or when they speak from embodiment. And, you know, that's an interesting thing, that you would look at the voice line that's showing up on your view meter. And I would add that not only does it represent past, present, and future right there, the human voice carries a vibration. It carries the depth to which an individual has embodied their being. We all, in the West, we talk about, in Western religion, body, mind, and spirit, but the Buddhists talk about body, mind, and voice. And that's my understanding, that you can actually just simply be taken into, it's my experience, taken into deeper and deeper states of consciousness through the voice of an individual who lives there and has lived in it. And so really what I'm advocating is a way or a path, a kind of universal awareness practice that has already been explored. And it's nothing new that I'm saying. It's maybe a somewhat new way that I'm saying it. And teaching it, but it's not new, because these are discoveries people have made forever. But when you start to live from an embodied present moment state in yourself, you become highly intuitive, you process information faster, you are intelligent, you're intrinsically compassionate, intrinsically trusting. I don't mean naively trusting, a deep trust in life, a deep trust in your being. You have forgiveness and you have humility. And all of this is not something you can teach someone. It arises spontaneously from learning to be present.
Well, you talk about the voice and the present moment. And when I look, of course, at the screen and I see that past, present, future representation there. And then you said, if I'm paraphrasing this, that the voice has its own vibration. Instantly, I thought of the ring of even of a Tibetan bell, for example, a big one, that vibration at the moment of striking that bell has a tone that we hear, but it continues on. But the voice, if I'm understanding you correctly, has a similar vibration that continues on, that we continue to hear it in our present moment.
Yeah, you hear it. Let's say your soul hears it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the words, but the words are not enough. The passion of the heart and the full embodiment have to be in the words. If Martin Luther King read his speech, we wouldn't. You know, they're lovely words, but when you hear him speak it, I Have a Dream speech is the one I was just thinking of. And you hear what that man has lived in that voice, and you hear what he's passionate about, and you hear what he's risked his life for, and you hear what he's calling us to, which we all do understand in a deeper place, is our own higher nature. That's what I mean by a voice vibration.
Yes.
And you know, it doesn't even matter what language. I went to India years and years ago in the late 70s, and I visited many ashrams. But when there was a teacher who spoke in English, I might have gone once. And then the rest of the time, I waited for those teachers to speak in their native language, Pashto or Hindi, because I wasn't interested in concepts. I wasn't interested in content. I was interested in embodied vibration, because I'd come to awaken to the realization that people's thoughts, you know, are a dime a dozen. But if they're embodied behind those thoughts, then they become truly carriers of transformation, carriers of an energy that can calm a person, bring them to tears, bring them to tears of recognition, tears of, now I'm hearing something deeply important to my soul, deeply important to my heart and my being. And to me, that's a really important aspect of what you're doing right here with an interview, because people are communicating ideas and people are communicating essence.
The book A Stranger in a Strange Land comes to mind. By the way, I've been reading that now for 15 years. I haven't finished it for the first time yet, so it's taking me a long time.
I love that book.
But there's a word in that book. I managed to get far enough into the book that I got this word. Now, I heard it said by someone years before I ever even heard of the book Stranger in a Strange Land. That word is, and it's a verb, to grok. And it
exactly.
isn't just to quote-unquote understand. It's my understanding of that word is it is to assimilate, to allow that outward expression of whatever it is that you are experiencing to permeate, envelop every soul and fiber of your being down to the soul.
So what keeps us from doing that becomes an important, you know, part of our discussion that I hope we'll get to.
Well, I actually want to go there. What is keeping us? Is it literally our technological age? Is it our social structure? Is it, what is it?
Well, my answer would be that it's developmental. If you think of an infant, they have no sense of self, so they have no sense of others, so they live in the eternal present moment. But they have no differentiated consciousness, no way to engage that present moment with any kind of effectualness, except through giggles, which will move us profoundly if we hear them, or cries of distress, which also move us profoundly so that we come to the aid of the baby. But over time, because the people, the mothers and fathers, obviously, who raise us all, are already differentiated into what we can call ego consciousness or subject-object consciousness, meaning when there's something that we see as an object, there's the me that sees it, the subject. The baby doesn't have that. So once we go into this stage of development where there's self and other, me and mine, you and yours, we start to have a profound filter, or let's say distance between us and the world. And then when we add to that the notion of time, that our minds are constantly, we learn from the past, and as a result we can adapt ourselves to the future, which gives us and has given us tremendous survival potential as a species compared to other mammals. But we end up poisoning the present moment in ourselves, because if we look at the past and believe it, and it creates guilt or regret or sadness, or then we are turning the present moment into guilt, regret, and sadness, because we're simply holding an image from the past and interpreting a particular way. Likewise with the future, you can scare yourself silly. You can actually create something more terrifying than the darkest of natural dark feelings, because we do have feelings that span the heavenly and the abysmal, that are natural to us, not created by thought. But future is always and only created by thought. So the filter that keeps us from both embodying deeply who we really are and that separates us constantly is what we could call an ego, which lives in concepts, ideas, beliefs about ourselves, others, past and future. It's interesting that one of the famous quotes of Jesus is, except that you be as a little child, you can't enter the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to understand that is not, oh, you have to become immature. It means you have to lose the sense of a separate self, filtering its experience. You have to become one with your environment, and then the environment you're in, even a hospital bedroom, or any situation, in that environment, if you are not separating yourself from it through thought, which is what the practice is all about and that I write about, then that environment literally becomes the kingdom. It becomes something that holds you at a profound level in which in your interior world and the external world unify. And when you speak from that place, you carry that ineffable quality of timelessness in your own voice, and you become, in my way of thinking, that is true human intelligence. And when you have that ability, you can lead change because you can adapt to change very, very much more easily than a person who's attached to an idea of who they are from the past, or a person who's attached to becoming someone at some point in the future through maybe success with their entrepreneurial enterprise, through finding the right person, through winning the lottery, through inheriting money, whatever it is we imagine is going to somehow liberate us in the future. So you're at my now a little bit longer than short answer to what keeps us from really grokking another is that we don't see them or hear them. We are filtering them through this concept of me or ego, which is built on a continuous state of arousal in our bodies due to the thoughts that we believe that come hundreds, thousands a day. And every one of them, he doesn't love me, he does love me, I'm not likable, I'm smarter than you. Everyone arouses sensation in the body, emotion in the body. And the cumulative effect of identification with that is what each of us means by me. Because if I say to you, what part of you is aware of me? What part of you is aware of hearing my voice? What part of you is aware of what you're looking at? And you look for the part of you that's aware, you'll never find it. And that's, you know, we could call it present moment awareness. We could call it consciousness without an object or consciousness without a subject. We can call it so many different things. The Tao, it has, you know, traditions, religious and spiritual traditions have given different names to this. It's actually the real meaning of monotheism, that the one God before all of gods is consciousness itself. So even if you believe in many, many godlike aspects in nature, for example, the one part of you that's aware of that becomes the one God. Now, as soon as you objectify the one God and see him living in heaven and making judgments on people, then now you've concocted something with your own intellect and your own imagination, and you put it on sale. And, of course, that's a complete misunderstanding of what monotheism really represents and is about. It was a tremendous evolutionary leap to realize that the part of you that's aware of your beliefs is more than your beliefs. The part of you that's aware of your thoughts is more than your thoughts. The part of you that's aware of your fears is more than your fears. And if you know that and you practice waking up in the middle of a story that's making you feel superior, suddenly in that moment you're just present and you can grok someone. If you wake up in the middle of a judgment, oh, he doesn't love me or he doesn't care enough about me, and you stop that thought right in its tracks, then suddenly you're looking at another human being, and whether he loves you or not isn't the issue. It's who is this other that's right there and has every right to love you or not? And some depth of freedom starts to happen in us. And because this show that I'm joining you in is so about how we're going to make a future that really works for everyone, then we need a universal awareness practice. We need a universal path of understanding our own minds. And not one based on our belief systems. Everybody has a right to their belief system, but yes, the only truth of a belief system of any kind is how it makes you feel and how you behave. So there's some wonderful belief systems out there that will make us one with our brothers and say, give us the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and ask us to behave as loving, caring human beings. Hooray. But there are a whole lot of other belief systems that divide us, like the one you were talking to me about before we started recording, the idea in the 70s that it was too expensive to pursue solar energy.
Yes.
You know? And because we said to ourselves, it's too expensive, because we put economics above, let's say, environmental integrity, mm-hmm. then we ended up where we are now.
So
the ego doesn't start to learn until it makes a mess of things. You have to mess up the marriage, and then you want to find out how to have a relationship. You have to kill love in order to find out how important it is to you.
Yeah.
And how and how to make love grow.
It's extraordinary in terms of not only the work that you have done. I also want to dive into, of course, this business of what you call deep work. I want to get a little bit more into that as well. I also want to let our listeners know that we're talking with author Richard Moss. He's written a book called Inside Out Healing, and it's transforming your life through the power of presence. And not the kind of presence you find under the tree. That is my analogy of this program, is when we have guests on, they are like a package I get to open up and I get to dive in and see what they're all about. And I find that an extraordinary gift every single program that we do. When people are going from day to day in our modern workaday world, trying to utilize the concepts found within the pages, within the covers of Inside Out Healing, I've heard it said that it can take up to 30 days to foster a semi-permanent pattern of discipline for whatever it is that you're doing for that period of time, for it to really start to become a part of you, who you are and what you're all about. Is that, as far as you know, is that timetable still true, or are the suggestions and the steps that you offer, can they take effect a little quicker? Because as you know, I mean, I've been through 5-day intensives, and as soon as the intensive is over, I'm thrown right back into the real world, and trying to remember how to behave and how to show brotherly love to the knucklehead who just cut me off on the freeway, or whatever the scenario might be, it's like, oh, I went through the 5-day intensive for nothing. I didn't learn a thing.
Okay, well, here's what I heard your question is, how long does it really take to change a fundamental behavior? And the answer to that is, I don't know. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, I think, Blink, wrote that research indicates that to reach what we would call mastery, and let's say in any athletic event or with a musical instrument, it takes about 10,000 hours of practice. I would say that I have certainly reached or exceeded 10,000 hours of practice of observing whether my mind is in the future, the past, in judgments of myself or judgments of the world, others, the situation, and brought myself back to my body, to my breath, to the immediacy of my perceptions, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times over the last 30, 40 years. When I started this, well, not 40 years, 36, 37 years now, when I started my work, because I had been shifted by a long retreat, I put my work into the form, my primary work into the form of 10-day retreats. And there was a time when I did about 7 or 8 of those a year. Now I do 3 a year. But I also meet with people in shorter amounts of time. What I think is that if you have been reading, exposing yourself to different things, testing different paths, you might reach a point where when you hear something really clearly and you're given a practice, for example, the practice of the mandala that is in my book, Inside Out Healing, and in the previous book, The Mandala of Being, you might be ready to take that practice on. You might grok it, so to speak, right then and there, and take that practice on, and you will have started down a path of transformation that, if you continue to practice, will absolutely, you will reach a level of freedom you never, ever imagined was possible, and you will reach the capacity for intimacy with yourself and life and other people that you never, ever imagined was possible. But it takes ongoing practice. So when you came back from the 5-day retreat, of course you were shifted. And when people come back from my 4-day or 10-day retreats, they're shifted. But my emphasis is not on the capacity to shift someone. If it was that, then why not just do ayahuasca or LSD or anything else? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say that I'm against those things, but they are powerful shifters that don't necessarily give you the ability to stay shifted or make something of that shift. Whereas if you're given a tool like the mandala in the book, the mandala work that's so simply and clearly explained in Inside Out Healing, and you decide that you're going to practice it, just like the Buddha said, don't believe me. Practice what I've shown you that has been my path, and if it works for you, then you'll know what I know. Whereas other religions say, believe this regardless of evidence. Believe these concepts of whatever you want to, I don't want to name or prejudice any religion, but when you have to believe something without evidence, then you're just in belief systems that are not actually embodied. And so your faith can be tested. And if you're afraid of having your faith tested, then you would usually project otherness, threatening otherness on other people, and you'll be afraid of their beliefs. So we need people who want to practice something so universal. And if it's what the only thing that any of us know that's absolutely irrefutably real is this moment. And then you can become a disciple of how your mind takes you away, which I've just outlined. If you visualize the clock, and the center of the clock is the now, the present moment, like the surfer experiences it without thought, just riding the wave completely in a state of flow, or someone who's practiced meditation long enough to not grasp at what arises in the mind and to not push away anything that arises in the mind, to just be able to allow the mind to do what it does without grasping or pushing away, without identifying, then you have this ability to start over right now. Start over right now, this moment, this breath, these perceptions, these sensations, these feelings, that other person who is not you, who is not an extension of your psychology, who's not here to save you, nor here to hurt you, which isn't to say that someone couldn't bless you in many, many ways or harm you. That's not the point. The point is that you're capable of perceiving another with enormous subtlety and intuition. Because you're really embodied in the present and you've learned not to follow the thoughts into judgments of yourself, not to follow the thoughts into judgments of other people, other businesses, other religions, even of your own situation, not to follow thoughts into the past, other than to learn from them and appreciate the richness of your life and the lives of others. When we stand on the shoulders of so many great, great human beings, I just saw the film The Butler last night.
And oh.
What an exquisite film. Just exquisite. Just to get that snapshot of the movement from horrible, horrible racial prejudice to the present day where we have an African-American president of the United States. So you see the evolution of consciousness graphically in that movie. But what is there also, just as graphically, if you look through my eyes, are people who are possessed by their beliefs and don't have any notion of what consciousness is or awareness is that would allow them. Of course, you see the change of heart of this central character, the butler at the White House for 40 years or some odd, you know, through seven presidencies or something. It's just exquisite. What a wonderful piece of film and art and history.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. There's another movie that springs to mind when you say that, when you speak of this, that was so profound. I mean, most people would say, oh, what a depressing movie, if they know the scenario of it. A Friend for the End of the World, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, with Steven Carell. Amazing film. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I haven't, so I can't join you in that, but I'll take a look. I just jotted it down.
And the basic scenario is that there is, and this is I'm not giving away anything here, the end of the world's coming because there is a giant asteroid headed directly for Earth, and there is nothing. Bruce Willis and his team are not available in this film, okay, like in Armageddon. And so the end does come in this film. But what's important in terms of not giving anything away is what happens to this character in his life when he finds out that the end of the world is coming.
Exactly. When you take away the future.
Yeah.
If you take away the future, instantaneously you take away the ego. You take away the separate me. If you take away the past, if you could just simply refuse to believe or identify with any thought about your life from the past, in that moment you become in present moment awareness. So with the asteroid coming, this man, I didn't see the movie, but I'll just guess, this man starts to live so deeply in the present moment that his heart opens extraordinarily, and his capacity to be touched and touched by another becomes exquisite. So maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but that's what would happen if you take away the future. And one of the ways we actually know that is the people who survive the Golden Gate Bridge when they jump are uniformly transformed. It takes about 2 seconds, a little over 2 seconds, when you jump off the Golden Gate Bridge to impact the water. 2% of the people, one person in 50 that jumps, lives. Those people have been followed up. This was done years ago. And their lives began anew, completely anew, often happy, really happy lives, family lives, all the things that they despaired through their thinking of ever being able to have, to a point where their thinking drove them. Despair is suffering that fails to teach, is something a Benedictine monk, Thomas Keating, said. Despair is suffering that fails to teach. But the people that jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and survive are transformed. So I have a joke in my work. And we can do the work that I'm going to offer them, which is very transformative, but there's no 100% guarantee of transformation. On the other hand, there isn't only a 2% survival.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, I can imagine that now that you've told me about the movie, I'm going to go see it.
It's available on Netflix, I can tell you that.
Okay.
I'm actually going to go back and watch it again. I mean, and when I went through my own intensives back in the early 80s through a couple of different programs, they would show certain movies. And then in the 90s, I went through some other intensives that were so much different. I mean, they had grown up, if you will, these particular ones that I went through. And I stayed involved with them for maybe 5, 6, 7 years in my first, through the end, near the end of my first marriage. And it was, you know, and they would have a list of movies they would recommend that would continue to speak upon the points that they would elucidate within the trainings. But it's most extraordinary that we are able to find those kinds of things, including books like yours, Inside Out Healing. My guest is Richard Moss. We're going to continue talking with him in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. We're talking with Richard Moss. He's the author of Inside Out Healing, Inside Out Healing, Transforming Your Life Through the Power of Presence. And we're talking about a lot of different things. I will let our listeners also know that you have, and I'm just glancing here right now, I kind of went through a count a moment ago, including this particular work, unless they're not all listed here. You have, looks like about 6 books. The one title that intrigues me the most is The I That Is We. And I want to just touch upon that for just a moment, because I want to get back to the work that you're doing, specifically the, and I'll put it in quotes, folks, deep work. Tell me a little bit about The I That Is We.
Well, it was the first book that I wrote. It's probably the one where I'm the least skilled as a writer, but where the energy of the transformation that I had gone through and was, and in many ways have continued to go through, was the strongest. So The I That Is We was a state in which I realized that there was nothing, no feeling, no sensation, no anything that I considered to be me that wasn't immediately continuous with, linked with, inseparable from, embedded in every other human being, the state those human beings were in, the trees, the grass, the air, the animals, the life, the whole of existence. I and the whole of existence became one. But the most important aspect of that was not the deep sense of oneness or unitive consciousness, some people might call it, or cosmic consciousness, some people would call it. That wasn't it. What happened was the realization that the most important relationship of all is with oneself, with the other, and with that deep consciousness, or whatever we want to call the mystery of life or God or whatever name we put to it. So The I That Is We is a book about my awakening and transformation, and starting into my work with groups and retreats in which I was attempting to bring them to those kinds of states of deeply awakened connection with each other, with yourself. There is no, you know, it's meaningless to me to meditate for personal enlightenment. It's meaningful to me to meditate so that I can become more and more present in all of my relationships, more and more available, more and more a man who is everyone, or an I that is we, where the feelings of another are affecting me. I actually know, for, you know, it's not a belief in me, I know that we don't have an individual body. You and I right now are affecting each other's health, and just because we're listening to each other and attuning to a kind of overlapping values and life experience, and my experience in my retreats, these 10-day retreats, were that as the energy of the group unified, people became more and more connected to each other. Healings happened all the time, and they continue to happen in these retreats, because there isn't such a thing as an individual human body. There is from the medical point of view, and when you declare someone dead, there's that dead body and the absence of who that person was for us. But as you are alive, if someone walks into your bedroom, your hospital room, as you are dying, and they have accepted absolute helplessness and powerlessness to affect or fix you in any way, you will feel less depressed, less pain, less alone. If someone walks into your room and they want to give you hope, when deep inside you already know your path point where your body's going to survive and there's no hope other than those rare things that we would call miracles, I've watched people close down again and again in hospice situations when the person who walks in isn't really comfortable with powerlessness. So there's a situation where a human being comfortable with powerlessness helps heal at least the spirit and heart of another human being who is in a helpless situation, a certain kind of helpless situation. And this goes on all the time. It goes on with children who act out in their families because they're literally embodying in some way and acting out, representing the energy of the relationship of their parents. They also have their own unique patterns, their own unique personalities and characterological aspects and physiology, but their physiology is being influenced by their brothers and sisters and the relational field between their mother and father or any other people that are around them. So there's a chapter in my next book after that I called The Ultimate Hospital, which was about what if people in hospitals were actually conscious of the effect they had on each other, and so their practice was to stay deeply in the present and conscious, even if they were surgeons or the person who cleans the garbage.
I remember hearing a study about some scientists who were conducting an experiment. And now who the scientists were and what the experiment it was is irrelevant. The point of the study was to recreate over and over again the experiment and see what the results were. And each time the experiment was conducted, different results were achieved. And they couldn't quite understand at first why, until they went back and they ran down, for example, they went through the login of all of the participants who were there at the time of the experiment. And let's just say there were 15 or 20 doctors or scientists involved in the overall experiment that took place over, let's say, a month's time. And they conducted this experiment, say, 15 times. Got 15 different results. And what they found was that every time they conducted that experiment, there was a different set of scientists in the facility at the time the experiment was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And the only conclusion that made any sense was that it was the people involved who were having an impact on the results of the experiment.
Yeah, exactly. There's a parallel to that. There was a study of very experienced midwives and new midwives with very little, you know, training at the beginning of their careers, and it showed again and again that the experienced midwives, through a broad spectrum of women in labor, women coming to give birth of different ages, different health, and everything. But the experienced midwives had far, far fewer complications than the inexperienced midwives. And the probable reason for that is that the experienced midwives were not anxious. They trusted the process implicitly.
Mm.
They knew how to read intuitively the signs of when the situation was dangerous and something needed to be done, whereas the inexperienced midwives walked in, took the blood pressure every time, put the stethoscope on the belly, listened to the fetal heart rate every time. And because they were anxious to make sure they didn't make a mistake, that in some way influenced what was going on with the women. And so there was a higher incidence of complications. And that's going on every day.
Yeah.
And what we don't understand, what everyone who's listening to us doesn't realize, is that no human being on this planet has any idea what health is, truly, until more and more of us live in the present moment. Because the incidence of spontaneous remission, so-called miraculous healings, I've seen probably a dozen of those out of, what, the 5 or 10,000 people that have gone through my long, it's not even 10,000, however many, that have gone through my long retreats over these 37 years. I've seen at least a dozen. I've seen hundreds of arms and shoulders and necks and elbows that, and depression and even the need for medications just stop, because the field that's created by people who over 10 days that begin to really connect with themselves, come into their bodies, connect with each other simultaneously, because there's no difference. The I is the we is the I at the level that we're talking about.
Yeah.
We don't really know what health is.
Yeah.
We don't, because people are so tormented by the stories they tell themselves about themselves. I'm not good enough. I need to try harder. I'm not lovable. I'm better than you. Or the future stories they tell themselves. I won't have enough money for a dignified old age. There won't be enough for my children. I mean, every one of those thoughts sends a message to your body, I'm under threat. The
yeah.
neurotransmitters flow out. The body reacts to the threat and becomes stressed, and health is affected by that. Long-term health is affected by that. Physical health is affected by that, but even more important, emotional health is affected by that. People who are believing their stories and are in that kind of stress where they're constantly angry, constantly getting angry at people, constantly judgmental, constantly feeling either superior or inferior depending on the context, safe or unsafe depending on the context, those people are not emotionally intelligent, therefore not spiritually intelligent, and every choice that they make in the voting polls, in the kitchen, how they feed their children, how they take care of themselves, every one of those choices is skewed by the lack of presence. So human health emotionally, psychologically, and physically really is in the hands of every single human being. And we have a profound responsibility to ourselves and each other to learn to stop poisoning ourselves with these kinds of thoughts. And that's what my work is about. That's what deep work is about. You said you wanted to know what deep work was about. Deep work is teaching people to recognize what they're doing to themselves and show them how they can change it. It's sometimes it's working with dreams in order to see what the deeper pattern is that the psyche is showing us. Our own psyches have access to profound intelligence way beyond what we could ever learn in school. And you can decrypt these messages from the unconscious through your dreams and use them to change the direction of your life. And as a result, in a sense, invent yourself or create yourself in a completely new way. So deep work is about inventing yourself, changing the trajectory of your life, becoming a person you may never have known was possible for you to be in terms of your capacity to love, in terms of freedom, in terms of freedom from fear, freedom from being self-involved, freedom from closing your heart when you feel when your health is weaker. I'm going to be evaluated tomorrow for hip replacement surgery.
Hmm.
It's been 4 months after an extraordinarily active life: mountaineering, rock climbing, surfing, bike riding. I mean, the last 10 years, no rock climbing, but. And now I haven't been able to walk without pain or bend without pain or stand without pain for 4 months. I haven't had, until recently when I went swimming, I haven't had aerobic exercise for 4 months. And it never did anything. But I actually got, even in some ways, happier because I just said yes at a deeper level than I did in my normal daily rhythm. And And so and now I know I'm not dependent on physical exercise for emotional or psychological balance. I'm not dependent on being in nature, walking in nature, bike riding, any of that, being outdoors to be happy. I'm not dependent on any of that. If all I'd have to do is tell myself a story, I used to be healthier, and that means that my life isn't as good now. All I'd have to believe is my life isn't as good now as it was, and I'd be miserable, but I don't believe that. And all I'd have to believe is my life will get worse if my hip doesn't get better, and I don't believe that, because it doesn't make any difference. What is what is,
mm-hmm.
and what my life is about is keeping my heart open no matter what.
Yeah.
And with practice, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you then communicate it to others who suddenly have an enormous freedom from fear and self-involvement just by being around us.
You bring to mind something that I learned back in school, that we are electromagnetic machines, you know, and this is in a very simplistic concept, and that there are those who do not believe that we affect one another. And so if we were able to teach that we are electromagnetic devices, then I would take them to the next step and say, okay, you have a microwave in your home, and you have a cell phone, you have various other electromagnetic devices. What happens when you turn the microwave on if you're standing next to it with your cell phone? Or you have your cell phone and you're talking to somebody on the phone and you get too close to your computer monitor or your TV set and so on and so on and so on. Your one device is affecting the other.
Well,
how is it possible that if we are electromagnetic devices, if you will, that we don't affect one another in the same way? And again, I'm asserting with you that we do. We absolutely do. And that's why in my conversations with people, I encourage them and sometimes really implore them to be conscious of what I like to refer to as your personal input. The things that you take in affect what you put out. I mean, that's, to me, a no-brainer.
Yeah, we are our brother's keeper, whether we want to be or not. As soon as you move out of your center, which is unnameable, really, but let's just call it embodied in the present moment, as soon as you move into someone who is being poisoned by beliefs from the past or negative anticipation of the future, or even positive anticipation of the future, since there's nothing as glorious as the present moment that will ever come,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you could imagine in the future, though you could certainly imagine something that makes you feel hopeful, that hope is shallow compared to being so embodied in the present that you don't need hope. But the what you're saying is, what I do in my retreats, for example, at some point in every retreat, I introduce aspects of what we might call energy work or energy awareness,
mm-hmm.
the ability to transmit energy by a shift in your own state of consciousness to another, so that many people, not everyone, will be able to feel it both as it flows from them and as they receive it. And the reason I do that is not just to teach people how to heal each other, though long, long ago when human beings realized that they could transmit energy and shamans and others went into deep, intense ritualistic practices to intensify their energy so the transmission would be stronger, and that healers are sometimes naturally imbued with that, but also develop it over time, they develop that ability. I'm not interested in teaching people about healing. I'm interested in showing them what that book, The Eye That Is We, is saying.
Mm-hmm.
If you change your state, you change your emanation, and that emanation affects others. It can come through your hands, it comes through your eyes, it comes through your voice, it comes through your field. Whether you call it electromagnetic or psycho-spiritual or...
whatever name, yeah.
Because it depends on what level we're measuring it.
Right.
What level we're looking at it. The point is, I give everyone I can an experience. I hope they don't confuse it as I'm teaching them to be healers, and I try explicitly to say, no, this is showing you that by receiving, by opening yourself to a different state in yourself, you change the state in another, and that the other can do the same for you, and therefore become responsible for your state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, become responsible, and that means practice. And the most important practice isn't, okay, believe this. It's actually, don't believe anything. Simply land where you are in your body, experience your own being right now, and whatever beliefs you use to navigate through life, be aware that they're the only truth of a belief about anything is what it makes you feel, what it arouses in you, and the behavior that it induces you to. That's the only truth of a belief, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a conservative or a liberal or a capitalist or a communist or a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Taoist. The only truth of your beliefs is what it arouses in you, sense at a level of sensation, emotion, feeling, and how you behave.
And the healing...
That's the only truth.
Right. And the healing, not to diminish it by any means, but the healing is a byproduct of all of that.
Exactly.
It just happens.
Well, thank you for saying not to diminish it.
No, by no means. Because I would never... I worked for a Christian radio station for 15 years, and there were programs on that station. They were call-in prayer programs. And after about 8 or 9 years of listening to these programs and producing them for the people that would come in and be the hosts, I would hear the same voices on the phone almost every week. And I'm going, did they not get their healing? What's the problem here? You know... As I learned more, there was more to it than that. This was no longer about them getting their healing. They wanted to be healed. Sure, they wanted to get the asthma taken away or the pain in the knee or the elbow or whatever the condition was. They weren't interested in that as much as they were the connection to the people on the other end of the phone, to the contact.
Well, that's what I learned in medicine when I practiced.
Yeah.
You know, the science that we're constantly evolving in medicine, at any given moment, half of it is wrong. We just don't know which half. but it's constantly evolving because we have a scientific method, an empirical method, which allows us to see these things are useful, these things are not so useful over time. I owe my life to medicine, so I'm absolutely a supporter of Western medicine, and I also know that it's quite limited, but I recognized right away that a lot of the patients that came to me came and then they'd come back because they needed compassionate listening. They needed someone to be present for them. And I think there's enough evidence that there's no question prayer works. So does that mean we should pray for people, or does that mean that every single moment you are a prayer? And if you're caught up in a thought that's causing you to feel jealous or envious or hatred, in that moment, your prayer is a profound, selfish self-involvement. Your energy field is low. Your body is suffering from the poisons you're putting into yourself. And everyone around you is less healthy because you are not living out of the fullness of yourself. We have to take responsibility for that. Because in terms of the intelligence with which we're going to solve the problems facing us on a global scale now, we not only need all of our brains, all of our scientific capacity and our technological inventiveness, we need a kind of spirituality that's not resting in belief systems. It's resting in immediate, profound, daily practice that brings you closer and closer to yourself, deeper into embodiment, closer to others, greater intimacy, and then you'll discover, everyone discovers, you need very, very little from the outside. So the whole consumerist nature of our society at this point is an attempt to fill from outside with things what cannot ever be filled from outside. And when a person lives what I'm talking about, and I for myself can tell you, I have a life so much simpler now materially than I had years ago. And the more simple it gets, the more easy it is for me. I need almost nothing except bare necessities, truly. And of course it's fun to create a pretty garden, an aesthetic garden. And it's nice to plant a tree for privacy and be creative with your home in that way. But there's so many people who just want to own something because they think it shows the world who they are, and they think it shows them who they are, and that's sad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ignorance.
It's one of the things that I've learned having lived here on the Central Coast, and of course I'm surrounded by more realtors than I know what to do with, and I'm not interested in, I am, but I'm not interested in buying a home. Right now we rent. But the realization came to me specifically regarding the place where we live, that the piece of paper that the family holds who own the property doesn't mean they own the land. That in 100 years, somebody else or nobody else will own that land, will have the right to possess. There's a great Irish song, and the line goes, you don't own the land, but the land owns you.
Yeah, you don't own your car.
No.
And your big house and your mortgage, it owns you.
And that's a truer statement, quite honestly. But even in the context, if you went back 200, 300 years, Richard, it's still the same thing. You don't own that farmland. You don't own that prairie. You don't own that cattle feed land, if you will, the grasslands where your cattle graze and roam and so forth.
Well, you shouldn't necessarily own the minerals that are underneath the soil that allow for a few generations, let's say, people in the Middle East
exactly.
to be fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
But I don't want to put it in the negative, Richard.
No.
I want everyone who's listening to us to understand not that we're doing something wrong.
Right.
It's that we're at a stage of development called ego.
Yes.
We live in the past, the future, and stories about ourselves, judgments of ourselves, stories and judgments of others and everything else. And then there is the present moment not conditioned, not affected by our thinking or by our beliefs, by our judgments. Therefore, a present moment in which there is no anger. Now, there can be vulnerability. There can be aloneness. There can be like changes in weather, times where you feel so, so dark. But if you don't think and you open your heart to those dark times, they initiate you to a deeper acceptance, a greater compassion for the suffering of others, and they don't hurt you.
They are part
what
of who we
are,
yeah.
What hurts us is our beliefs and our identification with these thoughts all day long, all day long, all day long. And, of course, we're bombarded from outside with everybody else's ideas and beliefs. Sooner or later, you have to decide that there's only the present moment. You want to be the master of your own relationship to what goes through your head, what goes through your body, at the level of food, at the level of thought.
Yeah.
And you can become a master of that if you want to. And you won't need a name like Christian or Jew or Buddhist or Muslim or anything else. You can invent yourself. You can invent whatever you think saintliness means or whatever you think beautiful humanist life means, whatever you think or want your life to be. You invent it by how you choose or what you choose to feed yourself through your thoughts and what you choose to put into your body with what you eat. And you can invent yourself in ways that have never been done before because as we all start inventing ourselves as more loving human beings, we have no idea of the richness of health and of intelligence and the ability to solve problems. So much comes from fear. And until people learn to have a really healthy, creative, inventive relationship with fear, you know, most people buy a house because they think if I have the right house with the right, you know, beautiful granite countertops, part of that is our spiritual call to a sense of beauty and aesthetic, and part of it is something from outside can make me safe.
Yeah.
And there isn't any safety from outside.
What?
And, you know, I'm going to be in Ojai, California. I don't know when the show or this interview airs, but I will be doing a retreat, a 10-day retreat. I call it Radical Aliveness. It's really deep work, my deepest of deep work retreats. People can see it on the website, the dates for it. It's at the Matilaha Canyon Ranch in Matilaha Canyon outside of Ojai. Glorious place. I've been working there for about 15 years. And very small group of people, usually are about 16 to 20 at that facility. And if people have been intrigued by what they've heard and they want to learn this, then of course they can go to the website. They can go to the book we've been discussing, Inside Out Healing, Transforming Your Life Through the Power of Presence. And I love that part of the world. I used to live in Ojai. I lived there for almost 9 years. And now I'm in Colorado, but I come back to Ojai very regularly. So you're in Santa Barbara, right? Hello?
That question again was?
You're in Santa Barbara.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. In Santa Barbara, California. Just down the road from Ojai, so to speak. Off of
Route
23.
Well, it's a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, indeed it is. And the thing that has struck me so interesting, you keep bringing up belief. When we are in our belief, I'm not trying to go negative here, understand. I'm just asking the question that when we're in our beliefs, I get the sense that we're not in the present moment.
No, we're not. But we become, you know, the belief is going to make you feel. When people believed the world was flat, they were completely wrong. And they thought if they sailed too far, they'd fall off. So they had fear. So they stayed in very, you know, they stayed in a smaller reality. Whatever you believe, whether it's a scientific belief, a religious belief, a philosophic belief, its truth, I'll say it again and again, is mm-hmm. what it arouses in you emotionally, psychologically, at a level of sensation in your body, and how you behave. So the only problem with a belief is if it comes between you and the health and well-being of another human being, or it comes between you and your own health and well-being. If you believe God wants you to try harder and your body gets anxious when you hear that thought, drop that thought. If you believe that God punishes anyone for anything and it makes you self-righteous and self-important and superior to think that you have the right God on your side and it causes you to harm another, you don't have the right God. So we have to take responsibility for what our beliefs cause us to create in our behavior, but we have to understand that there's no way to prove the truth of a belief. God is an invention.
Yeah.
And if we invent God in a way that makes us really caring, loving people, yippee.
Yeah.
That's a God I love.
It's one thing to share our beliefs. You know, I share mine with you, you share yours with me, and we learn a little of each other and these different ideas. But I learned 20 after 20 years of being around people of faith and so forth, you cannot argue belief with another person. You will lose every time.
You cannot argue belief with a person who's not conscious.
Okay.
That is, who borrows
their
consciousness.
Good definition.
They borrow their consciousness from their belief.
Mm.
So they're not conscious of their beliefs. They
right.
are embedded and manifesting their identity through their beliefs.
Uh-huh.
No, you cannot argue with them, and there'd be no point in even trying.
Exactly.
What you can do is love them.
Yes.
Or at least hold a large space in your heart for everyone and anyone, no matter what life brings to you, and through your field, you will influence people. I have this day to day, every day I have this experience of
yeah.
changing people simply through who I am and what I've lived.
This may or may not go over well with some folks in that respect, but I view what we're going through in our human existence right now in this time period as the equivalent of a lifeboat, and that we are encouraging everyone. We want everyone of all different persuasions, regardless. If you're human, come on board the lifeboat. However, there's one condition. You must be willing to let go of the paradigms of the past. They don't work. They won't work where we're going, and you have to be willing to let go of that. And if you're not, then you've made your choice. You don't want aboard this lifeboat. You know, we're not restricting anybody. And I don't know whether that's a fair way to put it or not. But the bottom line is that in spite of the fact that everyone has the right to their own beliefs and their own thoughts and their own mindset and so on and so forth, at the same time, there are those who are really looking out for the common good, the collective good, the community good and welfare.
It's true. And they're often invisible.
Yeah.
Because they're not trumpeting their beliefs.
Right.
They're just embodying them.
Yeah.
What's underneath a person who cannot shift their beliefs is fear.
Yeah.
So a person who needs a particular belief in a particular faith as a form of identity, and it will create community, and the community at church and other places can be healthy for people. There's lots of evidence that people who go to church and have a community that they can join in and that supports them are healthier than people who are more loners. There's values to community. We are collective deep in our in our evolution.
Yes.
We have in our heredity, in our genetics, the need for connection. But underneath inflexibility of belief is fear of fear. So the belief is actually a protection against fear. And so unconsciously, most people of a faith that is inflexible are actually worshippers of the god of fear. They're disciples of the god of fear. What you have to recognize, or what I recognized a long, long time ago, is that fear is a great god. None of us are going to vanquish fear. None of us are going to defeat that god. I know I won't. It's just that that's not my god. I'm not living my life to be safe, and I'm not living my relationship, my personal one-on-one love life to be safe, and I'm not doing my work to be safe, and I'm not owning what I own to be safe. And you don't need a belief to make you safe. True safety comes from landing in your body right here and now and beholding the absolute majesty of this organism that we are and the world in which we live. That's the deepest form of faith.
Yeah.
And there'll always be, you know, fear of some
form,
for others, the feeling of fear, the sensation of vulnerability, the sensation of but you can't, to use beliefs to protect us from it is very primitive.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, people will realize that. And as you say, get on the lifeboat, not because anyone's belief is wrong, but get on the lifeboat where the god of fear is no longer the ruler.
Right.
And we've decided that we want to be conscious and loving beings.
Yeah.
And if belief gets in between me and the ability to love, then that's a belief that needs to be questioned very carefully.
Yeah.
And of course there are people that believe and will harm others because they feel that that they have very strong judgments of others. And that's what racism was. That's what, you know, what we've working so hard to overcome in this country now for hundreds of years. That's what terrorism is all about. It's fear.
Yeah, that's
not the
fear.
Creation of fear. It's the fear in the people who act in a destructive way.
Yeah.
They're terrified. They're profoundly terrified. I remember watching the Nuremberg rallies and video of Hitler speaking, and I was astonished at the amount of fear that came off that man. Not the fear he was creating in people that watched him, and in me as an observer of him all these, you know, years and years after his death, but the incredible fear in the man that drove him that way.
Yeah.
And when you hear a strident voice, you realize you're listening to someone terrified. When you hear an inflexible politician, you realize you're listening to someone who's never made a healthy relationship with fear.
You know, that brings to mind very quickly here an episode of one of my favorite television programs, Star Trek Next Generation, and it was one where the captain was captured, and he was basically being psychologically tortured. But he began to realize that the gentleman who was interrogating him, he began to perceive him as nothing more than a scared little child who had had an experience that had changed him into the man that he was in that day. And the comment that the captain made to him that infuriated him, actually enraged him beyond anything up to that point was, he says, "I pity you. I pity you because of the fear, because of the brokenness that you choose to express through this present day experience." And I'm not, and I guess my point in that is when we start hearing those people you speak of, we start seeing those people that you have spoken of.
It's
and
everybody.
It is indeed. And we start seeing them as the little child. It changes our perspective. And I'm not saying that we pity them. I'm not even going there. I'm just saying that when you see an actual little child who is suffering, who is afraid. What do? You go and you comfort them. You do what you can to alleviate their fears. You encourage them. You wrap your arms around them. And you may not be able to do that literally with the adult in this scenario, but you can energetically.
Yes, and the important thing here, I think more important than the ability to comfort someone else who's in fear, is the ability to comfort ourselves when we're in fear.
Ah, yes.
And the thing that you wrap around your fear is your awareness, your consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a voice inside of us that doesn't let us be gentle with ourselves, that very few people have really taken the time to identify. And you need to find that voice that can be gentle with you when you're afraid.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to say, what I'm feeling now is fear, and the fear is making me have thoughts that someone else is responsible, or angry thoughts, or judgmental thoughts, or depressive thoughts, or self-attacking thoughts. I'm not going to believe these thoughts. I'm going to be gentle with myself. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to dance. I'm going to give myself a massage. I'm going to take a hot bath. I'm going to learn to be in relationship to fear until I know that while I can't conquer fear, I don't ever have to be obedient to fear in such a way that I'm harmful to me or anyone else.
Yeah.
I think fear is our great teacher of survival.
Yes.
But right now, we don't have to worry about survival because of the saber-toothed tiger that might attack us.
Right.
We have to worry about the thoughts that we believe and how they attack us and how we use thoughts to hurt ourselves over and over and over again when, for example, we attack others with our own thoughts.
Yeah.
So the most important fear is the fear you feel and how you address it in the present moment. That's a whole chapter in Inside Out Healing, is working with these very difficult feelings like fear and aloneness and abandonment and emptiness and powerlessness. Every human being has to find a way to be creative with them, inventive with them, gentle with yourself with them, courageous with them. And when we are less afraid of fear, then we have a greater capacity for intimacy and love.
Yeah.
Then there's less corruption, there's less
of all that
crime,
other stuff. Yeah.
There's you know, fear is the thing that we have to learn to hold in a new way. And every person has to learn it. You can't do it for someone else, but you can, by doing it in yourself, you carve a pathway energetically for others to be able to go further in their creative healing relationship with fear. I'm very aware of how much time we've spent. I don't know how these interviews work, but I need to get off pretty soon.
Yes, well,
and I don't want us to end up in a situation where you have to edit out things.
No. I only have a few more questions. I just wanted to let our listeners know that you're listening to an interview with Richard Moss, and he is the author of Inside Out Healing, Transforming Your Life Through the Power of Presence. Final few questions that I have for you. Number one, who is Richard Moss?
Well, he's this man that's talking to you, and he's 67 years old, almost, not quite, almost 67 years old, and he's been on a journey and will keep being on a journey. He still wonders who he'll be when he grows up. And but he's a man who has said, more important than anything else, I want to know what profound intimacy is. Profound intimacy with life, with myself, with one human being. And when I said life, I meant all beings, all things. And he's someone who's inventing himself, thought, you know, moment by moment, instant by instant, with every feeling that comes, with every thought that comes. He's creating himself, and he's an unfinished product. He's a work in progress.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, I truly, as I said, I believe the diagnosis of the problem in our world is two things. We believe our thoughts, and we're afraid of our feelings. And that's underneath politics, it's underneath terrorism, it's underneath crime, it's underneath everything. And once you say, I'm going to become a person who learns how to handle and make a creative, healthy space inside myself, a big space inside myself, for the most threatening of feelings, and that I am no longer going to be a victim of my own mind, I'm not going to poison myself with judgments of me or others or stories from the past that are so painful to me, or stories about the future that are so threatening to me, then that, which every single human being can do without a belief, just through a practice, will transform them. And so, till the last breath of this life, I will try to be the living embodiment of what I'm teaching so that it goes into the field and it helps others.
And how...
Come free of fear.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, I don't think we know yet. With two or three or more gathered in what I'm talking about, there's an enormous field, transformative field. We are limitlessly powerful, really, but not just alone. We are limitlessly powerful as we align ourselves with the present, which aligns us with life and nature, which aligns us with each other, which aligns us with the whole universe. We're not yet able to hold those kinds of energies. There's a very real discipline, a very real practice, and in many of my other books, I talk about what the practices are that allow you to handle bigger and bigger energies as we become more embodied and, in a sense, more powerful in that sense, not powerful over others, but radiating a current of timeless energy. So our ability to do that is going to continue to evolve, but I don't think there's any limit to it. We are that aspect of nature inventing itself.
RichardMoss.com is the website where you can find out more. You can check out the other books that he has written as well. And we've been talking today about Inside Out Healing, transforming your life through the power of presence. Richard Moss, thank you so much for the time that you've shared with us here on the program. It's been great.
Thank you, Richard. I feel and hear you as a kindred spirit.
Thank you. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.